It was March 2011 when anti-government protesters started their efforts in the southern Syrian city of Deraa to rid themselves of President Assad. The protests were eventually, of course, crushed with cruel force by the president. But the protests wouldn't die. They led eventually to all-out war. The world thought that Assad was finished, a man who'd never been destined to be Syrian president. He was only there because his brother had been killed. He was an ophthalmologist. He'd lived in London. He had a British wife. He was a lightweight. Surely he'd soon be gone. But he isn't gone. President Assad is still in power, and amid the terrible, terrible suffering of his people, the grim fact is that American planes are now sharing the skies of Syria with his forces. And the fight against the forces of Islamic State is a fight which sees the outside world allied with Assad, not formally, of course, but as the New York Times put it recently, there's been a quiet retreat from the demand that Assad steps down. Jeremy Bowen, our Middle East editor, has been to see the Syrian president at his palace in Damascus.
Mr. President, you've lost control of large areas of Syria. The jihadist group that calls itself Islamic State has emerged. There are perhaps 200,000 Syrians dead. Millions have lost their homes. The UN envoy, Stephen de Mistura, has called this the most serious humanitarian crisis in the world since the Second World War. Has Syria become a failed state?
No, as long as the government and the state institutions fulfilling its duty toward the Syrian people, you cannot talk about failed states. Talking about losing control is something completely different. It's like if you have invasion of terrorists coming from abroad, and the government is doing its job in fighting and defending its country.
When you talk about terrorism versus what you represent, you know the accusation that has been made, that you have concentrated your forces in recent years against the non-jihadist parts of the armed resistance, the armed opposition to you, and that you have tried to give Syrians essentially a false choice between you and between the likes of Al-Qaeda and Islamic State by trying to eliminate the middle ground. Perhaps it's worked well as a political tactic, hasn't it? Was that your idea?
Anyway, Obama answered your question when he said a few months ago that waiting for or depending on what they called the so-called moderate opposition was a fantasy. It was only pipetry. This is the reality. So if I want to
answer...
They're
still trying to build up what they call this moderate opposition, aren't they? But this time to fight against Islamic State.
But they said it's a fantasy. He said it's a fantasy. We all know it's a fantasy.
I've met some of those fighters, and they've said to me explicitly, we are not extremists, we are not Al-Qaeda, we are not ISIS. They've said, if Islamic State came here, they'd kill us. I met one group last year, actually in Damascus, who said, we'd like a country a bit more like Malaysia or Turkey. I mean, that is not jihadist, that's not dangerous, is it?
Why did the so-called moderate opposition evaporate? That's the question. If you have answer
some
to that
question...
Some say
that's because you've attacked them, because you've killed them.
Why didn't we attack the extremists like ISIS?
That's my question.
Ah, okay. So have you
attacked them in the same
you can say
force?
You can say that the government and the president is shooting themselves in the foot. We ask the ISIS and the al-Nusra to attack our military base, to kill our soldiers, to kidnap our supporters in order to eliminate the moderate opposition. Is that realistic? Nobody can accept
now,
it.
I've spent time on the front line with soldiers from the Syrian army who insisted that they were patriotic, that they were patriots. They weren't cold-blooded killers. But I've also interviewed people, and so have many other journalists and human rights people and so on, who say that they have suffered badly at the hands of Syrian soldiers. They can't all have been lying, surely.
How surely? Why are you sure?
Well, because the weight of testimony, Human Rights Watch, for example, 30th of January this year, has said that forces loyal to Bashar al-Assad, quote, have deliberately and viciously attacked civilians in opposition-held areas using indiscriminate weapons, notoriously barrel bombs.
This is childish story that keep repeating in the West.
It's childish.
Childish. Why? Again, if somebody who's against his people and again the regional power and the great powers and the West and survive, how? If you kill the Syrian people, they support you or they become against you. As long as you have the public support, it means you are defending the people. If you kill the people, they will be against you. That's common logic, common sense.
What about barrel bombs? You don't deny that your forces use them.
I know about the army. They use bullets, missiles, and bombs. I haven't heard of army using barrels or maybe cooking pots.
Large barrels full of explosives and projectiles which are dropped from helicopters and explode with devastating effect. There's been a lot of testimony about these things.
They're called bombs. We have bombs, missiles, and bullets.
So you would, but you wouldn't deny that included under the category of bombs are these barrel bombs, which are indiscriminate weapons.
No, there's no indiscriminate weapons. When you shoot, you aim. And when you aim at terrorists in order to protect civilians. Again, if you're talking about casualty, that's war. You cannot have war without casualty.
There are always casualties in war, and civilians die as well, but it is the responsibility under international humanitarian law for belligerents on both sides to do everything they can to protect civilians. And the accusation against the Syrian army is that by using barrel bombs, indiscriminate weapons, that you are not respecting humanitarian law by protecting your own people. What do you say to that?
First of all, we've been attacked in Damascus and in Aleppo. We've been attacked by the rebels, not vice versa. They've been attacking the Syrian with mortars. So you have to retaliate and defend your people. That's self-evident.
If you stopped barrel bombing, and it does happen, would you not help your own case internationally? There are people now who are saying that you are a potential partner in the fight against Islamic State and that you could be part of the solution, not part of the problem. And it would be quite an easy thing, wouldn't it?
So the first part of your question is about asking us to stop fulfilling our duty in defending our people against the terrorists.
So that's legitimate use of force?
Of course.
Including
of
barrel
course.
Bombs?
There's no barrel bomb.
We don't have barrel bombs at all?
We don't have barrels. Again, it's like talking about cooking pots. So we don't have cooking pots. We only have, like any regular army, we have bombs, we have missiles, we have bullets, and etc.
On the fight against Islamic State and Al-Qaeda, the US and others have said you cannot be a partner in that fight. Would you like to be a partner? Would you like to join the coalition?
Partner with who?
Partner with the countries that are attacking Islamic State at the moment.
Do you mean the alliance?
The Jordanians?
No, definitely we cannot, and we don't have the will, and we don't want, for one simple reason, because we cannot be alliance with a country who support the terrorism.
You've been very harsh in your criticism of the Saudis. Now, the Saudis say they are against Islamic State. They're frightened of Islamic State because Islamic State do not want a royal family in Saudi Arabia. So isn't it logical that they want them out? Why would they support them?
First of all, the source of this Islamic State ideology and other Al-Qaeda affiliates groups are the Wahhabi that's been supported by the royal family in Saudi Arabia. So just to say that we do and we don't, it doesn't matter. It's what you do, what the action that you are taking in order to prove that what you are saying is correct.
So you are saying then that the Saudis bear a high degree of responsibility for the emergence of these ideologies and of these armed groups?
Definitely. Definitely, there's no question. We don't.
So why have they rounded up and imprisoned so many Al-Qaeda sympathizers inside Saudi Arabia itself?
I think they think that once it's going to be their turn, because the society in that kingdom is more inclined to be a Daesh and to accept such ideology,
Islamic State.
Yeah, that's why.
Do you talk to the Americans? There are American planes in the air above Syria the whole time. Do you coordinate?
No, because they don't talk to anyone unless he's a puppet. And they easily trample over the international law, which is about our sovereignty now. So they don't talk to us, we don't talk to them.
But I'm curious that at a time when there's the American military in the air above Syria, and your people are in the air, your air force is also in the Syrian air force is in the air above Syria, that there haven't been any incidents between the two. No shots seem to have been traded. No planes have been shot down. That suggests to me, surely, someone's talking to someone here.
That's correct. But again, there's no direct cooperation.
Direct? Is it via Iraq? That's what some people have said.
That's true. Through third party, more than one party, Iraq and other countries. Sometimes they convey message. General message, but there's nothing tactical.
So they don't tell you, we're going to be bombing at Raqqa at 10 o'clock this evening, please keep out of the way.
We knew about the campaign before it started, but we didn't know about the details.
And is that a continuing dialogue that you have through third parties?
There's no dialogue. There's, let's say, information, but not dialogue.
They tell you things?
Something like this.
Do you tell them things?
No.
And apart from Iraq, which
other countries? When we do something in our territory or on our territory, we don't ask anyone, we don't tell anyone. But we just do it.
You don't say, look, if you see Syrian helicopters over a certain area at this hour, please don't shoot them down.
No, that's what I meant. There's no tactical cooperation or third-party through third-party cooperation.
Can we talk about the humanitarian situation a little bit? One of the effective military tactics the Syrian army has used is to isolate areas held by rebels and effectively to starve them out. But that has had the effect also of starving civilians. And that, again, is against the laws of war, starving civilians.
That's not correct for one reason, because in most of the areas where the rebels take over, the civilians fled and come to our areas, very simply. So in most of the areas that we encircle and attack are only filled with militants.
That they may have come to your areas, not because they want to come, but because their areas are being heavily bombed. I've been in some of the suburbs of Damascus, which are a huge contrast to here in the centre, where there's sometimes rubble, 20 metres high.
No wonder
people would want to get out of those places.
That's not realistic for one reason, because the natural reaction of any person, of the people, of the families, of the population, is to flee from any area where they expect a conflict. That's why they fled that area, because they expect fighting between the army and the militants. They fled that area, and they come to the government.
Valerie Amos, who's the UN Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs, said in a statement to the Security Council in January of this year that she criticised very harshly what Islamic State and others are doing, but she also said the government's failing. She said, for example, last year there were 16 requests for convoys, aid convoys, into eastern Ghouta near Damascus. Only 4 were carried out. The other 12 requests were, quote, unanswered, denied, or subject to conditions that could not be accommodated. And so for them, that adds up to the Syrian government blocking aid convoys to civilians in those areas.
The same areas are shelling Damascus every day, the same area that he's talking about. How can we prevent them from food, and we cannot prevent them from having armaments?
So if civilians suffer as a result of the lack of these convoys, that for you is unavoidable collateral damage?
No. We are talking about unrealistic, unobjective statements. We cannot discuss it as fact. You know, this is part of the propaganda against Syria for the last 4 years. So whatever Amos or any other official or any organization say something against us doesn't mean it's real. We have to verify what they say. And is it part of the propaganda? Is it politicized or what?
Syria's in ruins. There are hundreds of thousands of people dead. You've been the commander. You must bear command responsibility for some of that.
Yeah, according to the constitution and according to the ethics of your job is to prevent your country when it's under attack, not to fled and run away. And that's what we've been doing.
President Assad, he was talking to Jeremy Byrne. Jeremy's on the line now from Beirut. I'm fascinated, Jeremy, when you finished and he had said all those things to you, some of which would certainly seem to be flatly untrue. Did you get any sense that this was a man in denial, or does he genuinely believe those things? Is it hubris? Is it arrogance? Or is it just that he feels very confident in where he is?
It's hard to say. There's a lot of guesswork, of course, involved in this and COD psychology. But I think that he has convinced himself that everything he says is true. I think that he genuinely believes that he has saved his country from terrorism, from attack by outsiders, and that he is a protector of the people. That he, for example, he mentioned that people who have been displaced come over to the government side. Now, that's may well be because where they were is destroyed, or because they're better able to get relief supplies, perhaps, in government-held areas. But he sees himself as offering a haven to some of those. Now, it could be that he's just putting up a very good front, or that there are some deep beliefs at work here. And he's a stubborn man, and I think that these things are quite ingrained inside him, these beliefs.
Is he living luxuriously amidst all this catastrophe? Is his wife there? Did you get any kind of sense of the wider picture?
The interview was done in a guest house on the big presidential palace, which is a it's a working palace. They don't actually live there. He disappears from view of Syrians for weeks on end. He doesn't go on TV. His wife isn't on TV very often. She's got quite an active Instagram account. But no, he's someone they I don't think they live very lavishly, to be quite honest. Even when you may remember a few years ago, some emails were leaked, were hacked, actually. And it was from Mrs. Assad saying that it's the Harrods sale. Could you come and pick me up a few things? You know, this is not the normal behavior of the wife of a Middle Eastern potentate. So they are quite frugal, I think, actually, the way that they live.
And final point about one of the fascinating things there, you pressed him on whether there were messages being exchanged with the Americans, and this weird fact that American aircraft and Syrian aircraft are sharing the airspace. And he was interesting, wasn't he? But he seems to suggest there is no direct contact, but he acknowledged, I think pretty certainly, that there is contact, at least on a strategic level, between the Americans and him.
Yeah, well, via Iraq is the principal way. There have been reports about that, which is why I asked him about it, and he confirmed that Iraq is a middleman in all of this. And, you know, there's a Shia-led government in Iraq, and that, you know, he is as an Alawite, is a form of Shia. He's on that side of the religious divide in the Middle East, and of course the Iraqis have got a lot of contacts with the Americans, so in a sense they are ideal people to act as intermediaries in all of this. And the national security advisor in Iraq is someone who has very good connections with the Americans, and I think he's said to be the main person who does the talking.
Jeremy Byrne, thank you very much.